Looking at the next couple of verses, verses 10 and 11, at least, maybe verse 12 too, we find that Naomi has started her journey home, and her daughters have started to take that journey with her. And we saw last week that Naomi said to her daughters in verse 9, "Go and return each to her mother's house, and the Lord deal kindly with you, as ye have dealt with the dead and with me." So we talked about the kindness of the Lord there, the loving kindness of the Lord, the faithfulness of the Lord, his steadfast love, and how that they had, in a measure, showed that to their husbands and to Naomi herself. And so Naomi pronounces his blessing on them, but she sends them home. And she says, as she sends them home, that she asks that the Lord would grant that they might find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice, and they wept. So that's where we left off last week. She has sent them home, and they have wept over the idea of leaving her. And then in verse 10 and 11, we find their, verse 10, their response, in verses 11 through 13, her response. In verse 10, when they heard her say, "Go home so that you can find rest, so that you can find a husband," verse 10 says, "And they said unto her, Surely we will return with thee unto thy people. And Naomi said, Turn again, my daughters. Why will ye go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband, if I should say I have hope. If I should have a husband, and also tonight, and should bear sons, would ye tarry for them until they are grown? Would ye stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord is gone out against me." So here's her response to them, and it's going to be in response to their initial reaction to go home, go and return home. They said unto her, "Surely we will return with thee unto thy people." And you really see that sincerity on their part, surely. That's their sincerity, and you kind of see a little bit of a zeal, surely. You know, there's a little bit of a zeal, surely we'll go back with you. And you see their purpose of heart and their unity, because they both say, "We will, surely we will." And, you know, there's a sincerity there, and there's a zeal there, and there's a unity there, and there's a purpose of heart there. But before they truly go on, she's going to have to know, and they're going to have to know, and the Lord is going to reveal to them the real motive of why they want to go on. One of the commentators said, note the expression, "We shall return," instead of "We shall go with thee." It's, "We shall return to thy people." And he commented, and he said, in a way they're identifying themselves with their mother-in-law. "We're going to return with you, like we've been there to begin with." You know, there's this identification with her, as if they had come with her from Judah. You can kind of see that little bit of an identification. And what Naomi's going to do in her admonitions to continue and stay is to show them, no, you're really not from Israel. And even if you are to return, there's not much waiting there for you. So if they return, if they go with Naomi, she wants them to know, and I think whether she does it intentionally or unintentionally, we don't know, but the Lord, through her words, wants them to know that there's going to be a cost, there's going to be a loss, there's going to be a forsaking that they're going to have to do. They're going to have to forsake their country. Thy people, you know, will be their people. Which is what Ruth is going to say. They're going to have to leave their family. They're going to have to leave their friends. And they're going to have to leave their gods, so that they won't be Moabites anymore. And if they truly go with her, in a sense, they'll be Israelites. You kind of see this purpose in their heart. Surely we will return with thee. Well, we're ready to do this. We're ready to make this commitment. We're ready to go back. We're ready to give everything up. But I don't think they've really thought about it, what it would really mean. In a way, Naomi's next words will kind of put to the test the strength of that desire. Oh, surely we will go back. In other words, is this commitment that they initially make, this purpose of heart that we see in verse 10, is it based on emotion? Is it based on an obligation? We feel this obligation that we should do this. Is it based on, well, this is the custom, this is what we're supposed to do? Is it based on, well, we love you, but is that love enough? I thought about if it's based on, we love you, Naomi, and we want to go back with you, then is it just a love for Naomi that will carry them through the journey and what they face at the end of the journey, or does there have to be another love added to their love to Naomi? And I think there has to be another love added to the love that they have for Naomi, or the affection they have for Naomi. They have to love Naomi's God, because that's who Naomi loves and that's who Israel loves. So did they say this out of a deep desire and a deep devotion, or did they say this out of emotion? And sometimes, you know, people get caught up in the moment, the emotional moment, and they make this commitment and they say, I'm going to do this, and yet it's emotion. It's just based on that moment, and if they were to follow through with that commitment, they would regret it afterwards. It would eat away at them and they would chafe at it. And so I think many of God's people start out saying what Rebecca said when Eliezer asked her if she would take that journey back, and turn over to, it is somewhere in Genesis, if I can find it, 24. In Genesis 24, and I'm not going to read this chapter, I'm just going to read one particular verse here, because I picked out two things that God's people today can say at the moment of emotional zeal, at the moment of being caught up in, oh yes, I see your desire, I want that desire too. And when Abraham sent his servant Eliezer to find a wife for his son Isaac, and he came to the land of Abraham's fathers, and he found Abraham's family, and he found a woman at that place who fulfilled the requirement that he had set before the Lord, show me if this is the woman that you want. And he met her family, and he spent time with her family, and he told her family the purpose of heart that he had, that he wanted to bring a woman back to marry Abraham's son Isaac. He asks Rebecca this question, and in verse 58, after the matter is put before her, it says in verse 58, and they called Rebecca, and they said unto her, wilt thou go with this man? And she said, I will go. You know, I think she said that with all sincerity, but I think she knew that she was going to have to leave her father and her mother, and that she may never see them again. And she had never really met this man. She only knew from this servant's description of him a little bit about him. She had to really be led by another greater desire, which would be a devotion. And so they called her and they said, wilt thou go? And she said, yes, I will go. And the moment that she said that, the Lord held her fast to that commitment that she made. In a sense, Naomi has this unspoken question that she's asking these women without asking these women. She's saying, go back. But underneath, the Lord is saying, through Naomi's words, are you willing to really go? And they say on the surface, oh yes, surely we will return with you. And so Naomi's next words will really say, after will really kind of place before them the question the second time, after she says, well, this is what you can expect if you go back. And then in a sense, one will say, no, I don't want to. And the other will say, yes, I want to. Rebecca said, will you go? I was asked, will you go? And she said, I will go. And I thought, today many people start out the journey with the Lord for running for the prize, to lay hold of that best place, that closest place with the Lord. They hear that call, will you go? And in an emotional moment, they say yes. But they don't really last. They start out a little of the ways like Naomi's sister did, or Orpha did, and then they find the obstacle set before them and they decide, no, I don't want to go, and they go back. But once she starts this journey, Naomi wants these women to know, if you start this journey and you say, I will go, there is no chance to go back. Once we start out, I'm not going to turn around, and you can't turn around either. So she wants to make really sure that there's a commitment on their part. I thought about what the Apostle Paul says to the Philippians when he says to run for the prize. And he gives himself as an example, saying that in Philippians, that third chapter, that he runs. He said, I run for that prize, for the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. How many of God's people will start out saying, I will run, just like they say, I will go? And they do that because, well, there's others running with them, and they're caught up in this zeal and this moment of love for the Lord and love for God's people. And many start out saying, I will run, but the true test of that commitment comes when somebody else that's running with you turns around and stops and goes back. And, you know, this is going to be a test for Ruth, because I'm sure she loves Orpha. They have a bond there that's united them together in the loss of their husbands. And if Orpha says, oh yes, I will go, yes, I will run, yes, I will return, and Ruth says the same thing, but now, at the end, a few verses after this, Orpha's going to say, no, I'm not going to. Now Ruth is faced with, well, if I go, I'll be the only one from Moab going. I won't have another companion from Moab, somebody that we can reminisce about the things that it was like when we lived there, and family and friends that we knew. If she goes, there's nobody she can talk to about, oh, her mother, her father, her brothers, her sisters, her aunts, her uncles, people that she knew on the street, the culture. If she goes, she's going to go on alone. And when we make that commitment to run for the prize, to say, I will go, the Lord really, in a sense, wants us to know that we may start out with others, but we have to be willing to go on alone. We have to really be willing to face the obstacles that are there before us. And whether Naomi realizes it or not, this is what she's doing. She's going to find out the true measure of these women's commitment. I thought about when Paul tells God's people about the race, and I thought of a good scripture that kind of shows Paul telling you about the race and then telling you about all the obstacles in the race. And if you turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and look at verse 24, we find that this is kind of a companion scripture to back up what Paul has already said in Philippians, when Paul says, as we studied there in Philippians, that I press toward the mark for the prize. I'm sure when he said that, that stirred hearts. And I'm sure that there were saints that read that epistle or heard those words from Paul's lips and thought, I want to press towards the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus too. I want to do what Paul does. And a lot of people maybe went along with them and said, I want to do that too. But if you look past the years that you've been running this race for the prize, that you have been committing your heart and life wholeheartedly to the Lord as your bridegroom, how many times have you started out with others and pretty soon it's just you going on alone? And that's a real test. So Paul, when he talked to the Corinthians about this racetrack, basically he's going to tell them about the race, and then that there is a prize for that race, but then he's going to say, guess what? When you run that race, it's going to take several things on your part. And I kind of broke it down into four different things that, actually from Corinthians, three different things. And first of all, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, he says in verse 24, know ye not that they which run in a race run all. Now you all run, but you also run all out. But you all run. Everybody's on that racetrack. A lot of people are on it and don't realize it. And some people are on it and realize it, and then they just take a detour. But he says, know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? And so he gives you the first, rule for the race, or one of the rules for the race. And I call this a desire. There has to be a desire. He says, run that ye may obtain. So I call that a desire. Now, Naomi has a desire, and Orpah, her sister-in-law, also has a desire. And their desire is seen in that verse 10, surely we will return with thee unto thy people. When Naomi gets done talking, Orpah doesn't have as great a desire as she did when she started out, because she realizes, oh gosh, if I do that, it's not going to be as good as I thought it was going to be, or as easy as I thought it was going to be. So there must be a desire, and so Paul says this is the first thing you have to have, and usually most people start out with this desire. But then there has to be, as we see in the next verse, a discipline. In verse 25, and every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate, or what is another word for temperate? Self-controlled, which is kind of another word for disciplined, in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. And he uses that analogy of in the Olympic Games of that day, those people that participated in the games, they really were disciplined in preparation for those games. In our spiritual race, there needs to be that discipline. And Paul says, I therefore, in verse 26, so run not as uncertainly, and so fight I not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection. There is that discipline that he has in his life that goes hand in hand with that desire. And in a sense, Naomi is going to have to, or whoever, if her sister was to go with her, when she listens to Naomi's words, when Ruth and Orpah listen to these words, they're going to have to really go all out. It's all or nothing if they make this journey. They can't run uncertainly. They can't say, oh yeah, I want to go, and then 10 miles away or 20 miles away or 100 miles away, say, oh, I'm homesick, I miss everybody. And maybe they're talking to other people about what it's like in Bethlehem, Judah, and they realize, oh my gosh, the language is different, the culture is different, the people are different, the worship is different. It's not like it is at home, so if I do this, I'm going to have to really discipline my life and let go of things that I am comfortable with. So there has to be desire and there has to be discipline. And as we heard Paul say in Philippians 3:14, there has to be a direction. I press toward what? The mark for the prize. So I thought of those three things there that you could apply to Ruth and to Naomi and to her sister Orpah. They start out and there's that desire, surely we will return, but Naomi's going to, in a sense, say, you're going to have the discipline and the direction. You're going to have to really know what's at the end of this journey, what to expect at the end of this journey. And she just doesn't give them a rosy picture. She tells them all the worst case scenario, probably because she doesn't really realize that the Lord has something else in store. That's all she can really see from her perspective is the worst case scenario. But I think Naomi has a desire, and I think she now has the discipline to return, and she's headed in a direction. She's got a direction. She's headed home. If you're going to go with her, she can't do it for you. You have to really have the same desire, have the same discipline, and have the same direction. Remember that running for or pressing toward the mark for the prize. Remember that that mark was, in a sense, first of all, a white line that was drawn along that race course. And if you've watched the Olympic Games, everybody's in their own lane. And they have to stay within that lane and follow the mark on that lane. And if you got outside of that mark or that lane, then you were disqualified for the race. So if Ruth is going to make that journey, then she's going to have to follow the rules. And the rules in Israel are different than the rules in Moab. She probably can't dress like she used to. She probably can't talk like she used to. And she certainly can't worship like she used to. So things are going to be different. So if you didn't follow the mark, you were disqualified. And then also remember, pressing towards the mark for the prize is the goal. It's what's at the end of the race. And to me, when you see what's at the end, if that means more to you than what it is like along the journey, then anything is possible. The journey is bearable. And really what Ruth is going to see at the end of this journey is the God of Naomi and the people of Naomi. For some reason, her heart has been so stirred that she said, your God will be my God, and your people will be my people, and that's what I see at the end of the journey. And I don't care what it is that I have to go through to obtain that, that's all that I see. In other words, it was not an emotional moment for her, it was a devotional moment. It was more devotion than emotion that brought her on that journey and caused her to take that first step. You know, many today start running, but they don't go on. They're hindered. What did Paul say to the Galatian saints when he talked to them? What did hinder you that you should not obey the truth? They get impatient, or they get tired of the discipline, or they see the obstacles, or they realize, gee, it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be, or I thought there'd be more people running along with me, and the longer I go on, the less people that I see. I keep thinking about how in Jesus' ministry, he started out with multitudes following him, wanting to be his disciple, and my gosh, after a period of time, at the end of his ministry, there were no longer multitudes wanting to be his disciple. It narrowed down to just a few. He said, will you also go away? Just to the 12. You know, we start out, and it's great doing being victorious and overcoming with a crowd pushing us on, but what happens when we have to go on alone? Well, Ruth and Naomi, in a sense, are going to go on alone right away, so it's going to work out good. They're starting out in the worst possible case scenario, and it just gets better as it goes along. Naomi's next words, and this is what I want you to think about in verses 11 and 12 and 13, her next words, whether she does it on purpose or not, or whether she just really believes this, is will force these two women to decide if they really want to do what they say. They say, oh, we surely will return with you. We'll go. And so she really wants them to do what they say, and so she's going to put it to the test. Now she'll take the lead, and they're going to have to follow. And what she's going to do, in a sense, is lead them into unknown territory. Ahead of them will be, as I said, different customs, different behavior, different dress, different language, different type of worshiping. They've not seen a tabernacle. There's no temple yet. It's the time of the judges, so they've never seen what it's like to have the priesthood ministering and sacrifices being offered unto the Lord. They don't know about a burnt offering or a sin offering or a trespass offering or a meal offering. They don't know about not working on the Sabbath or not cooking a meal on the Sabbath. They don't know a lot about the laws for Leviticus or Deuteronomy, so they're not really that familiar with that, except maybe what they've seen in a limited basis on that household, and even then it was probably pretty limited. So it'll be a really big change when they get to Bethlehem, Judah. And I thought, sometimes we don't know the real motive of our heart until somebody forces us to examine our heart, and that's really what's going to happen. Orpha didn't really know the real motive of her heart until Naomi forces her to examine it. And she's going to say, that's really not what I want. Ruth, at the end of that examination, is going to say, hey, this is what I want. I still want it. It's really what I want. One commentator said, promises of speech and purposes of spirit should walk hand in hand together. I really like that. You make a promise, then it should go along with the purpose. And a lot of people make a promise and they don't follow it up with a purpose in their spirit. They say something with their lips, a promise of their speech, but there's no purpose in their spirit. But those two, for a victorious walk and an overcoming walk, and a walk that brings forth true fruitfulness, go hand in hand. None ought to promise with their mouths what they do not purpose in their hearts, which I thought is really true. In Matthew 21:30, if you look over at that scripture in Matthew 21:30, look at something here that is said. In Matthew 21:30, we find that there is this certain man that has two sons, and this is a parable. And he came to the first son, and he said in verse 28, son, go work today in my vineyard. And he says in verse 29, I will not. But afterward he repented and went. And he came to the second and said likewise, and he answered and said, I go, sir. And he went not. You kind of see here Jesus is talking about somebody that has a promise to do something and not carried through on it. And how many of God's people make that promise to go with him all the way in holiness, and yet they don't carry through on it? There has to be that purpose of heart that goes along with the promise that comes forth from our lips. And Naomi's words are going to reveal the purpose of heart. So verse 11 is the first of her arguments to dissuade them and persuade them, and whether she realizes it or not, to prove them, to test them. And so Naomi says, again, turn again, my daughters. Why will ye go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? So Naomi tells them again to return home. She's saying, turn again. And she's really just saying, turn back. Turn back again. Return home. Now she's turning back and she's returning home, but she's not from Moab. She's returning to her real home. And in a sense, she's saying, look at where you were born and raised. Look at, this is your home. This is your culture. These are your people. You really need to go back to your home and return. Now she's going to repeat this in verse 12 when she tells them to turn again, and she's going to again repeat it in verse 15. She's going to say, return to Ruth in verse 15 again. One more time, she's going to say to Ruth, return. And in chapter 1, the word return and the word turn back are used repeatedly. Return is used 6 times in this chapter. It's used in verse 6, and in verse 7, and in verse 8, and in verse 10, and in verse 15, and in verse 16. Return, return, return. And the word turn back is used 2 times in verses 11 and 12. Turn back or turn again. So would you say that's a prominent word in this chapter? And guess what? After chapter 1, you never see that word again. You don't ever hear that word return, because they're there and there is no going back. Once they reach their destination, there's no going back, and there's no admonition to go back, because the heart has committed itself to that path and that choice. But here Naomi reminds them of where they are from, not where they are going. She first has to remind them, this is where you're from, before they're willing to go the direction that she is going. They're from Moab, they're not from Israel, and that's true. And they must be willing to let go of everything of Moab if they're going to enter into Israel. And the chances are they probably may not be received that well because there's this animosity between Moab and Israel, and they're not Israelites, they're Gentiles. They're kin of a sort, but they're still not Israelites. So Naomi says, tells them something, turn back. And then she asks them something. Why will you go with me? She's really saying, why do you want to go? She's going to give them the reasons not to go, but she wants them to think about it. Why do you want to go with me? She wants them to know what they're giving up, but also we need to know the cost of the choices that we make. And in a sense, the Lord is weeding out and narrowing, in a sense, from those two women, those that really don't want to go all the way. I thought about how many times in the Bible the Lord does this, how that he takes a large number and he kind of whittles it down. I told you already that Jesus, when the multitudes began to follow him, he turned to those multitudes, and we've talked about this before in Luke 14, 25 through 28, if you go back and read that portion, and we are familiar with that scripture, the multitudes are following him, and you get the idea that the multitudes want to be disciples. And he turns around and he looks at those multitudes and he talks to them and he says, basically, you have to leave your father and your mother and your brother and your sister, and you have to love me more than them. He really tells them, choose God first and put him before everything and everybody else. He's trying to weed out from this multitude those that won't turn back halfway through, that will go all the way with him. And then he goes on to say, and guess what? You have to be to choose God first, to put him before everything else, to forsake father and mother and brother and sister and love him more and be willing to bear their own cost. Then he says, and this is a verse I wanted you to look at. It's in Luke 14:28, because in a sense, this is what Naomi is saying to these two women. So in Luke 14:28, we find basically what Naomi is going to tell these women to do when she sets before them all these arguments and obstacles and reasons why they shouldn't go with her. And in Luke 14:28, Jesus says, for which of you intending to build a tower sitteth not down first and what? Counteth the cost, whether he have sufficient to finish it. And basically what Jesus was telling those that started out following him is you need to count the cost. You need to be aware of the fact that it's not going to be easy. You need to realize that you have to put me first, and you have to let go of a lot of things. And so we find that Jesus narrowed down that multitude through this particular sermon that he gave them. And later on, as he began to minister, some of his teaching narrowed it down a little bit further, because after his teaching, it says a lot of people left him after that. That they didn't want to hear that. And then the other example I thought about how the Lord narrows things down when he brings us along this way. And the circumstances of our life do that, but a lot of times he'll let us know ahead of time. And people that we talk to that tell us about this wonderful truth, Erlene was up front and honest with us, and she said, you know, it's not a popular way. Not everybody will go this way. I thought about Gideon, and when Gideon started out in Judges 7 with that great number of people that were going to fight that battle with him, I think he started out with 22,000 people. I think he started out with 22,000 people, and then he narrowed it down to 10,000 people, and then he narrowed it down to 300 people, if I'm right, in Judges 7. I'm pretty sure. Let me double check. Yeah, Judges chapter 7, and I think it's verse, I think I highlighted that. I was reading that just this afternoon. Judges 7, verse 3 says, "Now therefore go to proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. And they returned of the people 22,000. And there were 10,000 left. So that means there were actually how many? 32,000. So 22,000 started out, or 32,000 started out, and 22,000 left. And then the Lord said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will try them for thee there. And we find that he asked them, everyone, to drink water, and whoever lapped water with his tongue like a dog lappeth, they were separated, and he that bowed down upon his knees to drink, they were separated. And when they were separated, there were only 300 left. So the Lord again narrowed down that large number to follow after him. And I thought it's interesting that a lot of times the Lord will take that number, and here we have a number of two that's going to be narrowed down to one that are going to go back with Naomi. But part of what will narrow it down and cause one to stay and one to go back is the arguments that Naomi puts. And the first argument that she gives after she asks this question, and I bet they probably thought about it, well, why do you want to go with me? And they probably each had their own reasons. I don't know what Orpha's reasons are. Naomi will express hers in that 15th verse, which is so precious. Orpha doesn't really say, and we have no idea what they are. I think probably they were fleshly reasons, emotional reasons, maybe reasons of obligation or reasons of natural affection, or Ruth was going, and so I'm going because Ruth is going, you know, whatever those reasons are. But she's asked, why will you go with me? And then she tells them all the reasons they can't go. And the first reason she gives is, well, I can't provide any sons for you. Are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? So I don't have any sons, and because I don't have any sons, you don't have any husbands. And the reason she's saying this is over in Deuteronomy 25, looking at verses 5 through 10. And there was a law that was put down that made a provision for the family line, no matter what happened, to at all possible costs be carried on. And in Deuteronomy chapter 5, looking at verse 5, we find it says, Deuteronomy 25, I'm sorry, verse 5. Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. And verse 5 says, if brethren dwell together, and one of them die, and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her, and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. Now this was called, my Bible calls the Levirate Law. And Levirate comes from Latin, meaning husband's brother. And it just means that if the husband died, in order that his line would continue, the brother would marry her, and the first son that she had would carry on his brother's line. The second son that she had could carry on, you know, the next brother's line. So Naomi's referring, in a sense, to the hopelessness of her having any additional sons, because, hey, I don't have any sons that can marry you. And she's not even thinking about a near kinsman other than just only my sons can do this. I guess she isn't aware that until she gets back to that land that maybe there is somebody that can fill that position. So if somebody was childless, then the widow could marry that brother, and that brother could raise up an heir I looked up in my Encyclopedia of Judaism online, and it says, marriage contracted between a widow whose husband had died childless and the brother of her deceased husband is what Naomi's referring to here. The intent of the commandment requiring such a marriage is that the first son that she bears shall be accounted to the dead brother, and that his name will not be blotted out of Israel. And then in Genesis 38, the episode of Judah and Tamar shows that this custom was an ancient custom among the Israelites. One of the things that Tamar did, being a widow, was Judah would not give his son to her so that she could raise up, have a child, and carry on her first husband's line. And of course, she slept with Judah, played the harlot, and slept with him, and became pregnant so that she could carry on that line. Well, she did it under this law. That's the reason that she did it. And so it says in Genesis 38, the episode of Judah and Tamar shows that this was an ancient custom among the Israelites, as well as among neighboring peoples. One of the basic differences between the Genesis story and the laws in Deuteronomy is that Genesis has no stated provision for the release or the ceremony required if he refused to marry his brother's widow. In Deuteronomy, when we get later on into Ruth, there is this provision made if the individual that has this obligation to marry the brother's widow says, oh, I don't want to do it. Then there is a whole provision made for what you do in that case. But in Genesis, there's no provision. But here under the law, there was. So we find here that the first thing that Naomi's going to say here that is a justification for turning back is, I don't have any sons, and because I don't have any sons, there's nobody here for you to marry. So what is the point of going with me back to the land of Bethlehem, Judah, because you obviously can't get married. And basically, underneath that is this hidden idea of, and by the way, who would even want to marry you? You're a Moabite. So what are the chances of you even getting married? You'd be better off to stay here and just find a husband among your own people, and that way you can find rest in the house of your husband and a measure of blessing. And so this is a pretty good argument that she puts before them. But also she wants them to know that if you go with me, then you have to count the cost. And it won't be an easy way. And so I really like the way the Lord is, whether Naomi intends to do it or not, using this to really test their purpose of heart. In the next couple of verses, she's really going to repeat herself, but expound on it a little bit more. Reinforce this idea of, I'm sorry, there's just no hope for you if you come with me for any sort of family life or any sort of fruitfulness or any sort of blessing. So it's better that you don't go with me, that you just go back. And you really see at the end, Ruth is not going to be shaken from that purpose of heart. Surely, I will go with you.
Praise the Lord.